So tonight's story is about Bahia, B-A-H-I-Y-A, and continuing our series of favorite suttas. This particular story is from the Udana, so it's one of the earlier texts, and some of the Pali canon is sort of intimidating. This is actually two volumes. This is the Udana and the Itavuttika, and it's only that thick. So, and the stories are quite short and very sweet. So, often the suttas will start like this one. Thus have I heard, at one time the Lord was staying near Savatthi in the Jeta wood at Anathapindika's monastery. In fact, the sutta that I talked about last time started the exact same way. He was in the same place, and it's not surprising, right, because they spent the rains retreats there. So it's not surprising that a lot of the stories for, you know, over 25 years. So it's not surprising that a lot of the stories are in Savatthi. But instead of continuing on with that scene, they jump, and they say, at that time, Bahia, of the bark cloth, was living by the seashore at Suparaka. How often do you hear about the seashore in the suttas, right? Not very often. He was respected, revered, honored, venerated, and given homage, and was one who obtained the requisites of robes, alms, food, lodging, and medicines. So this guy was a teacher. And as someone, some wag online said, you know, today he'd have a small meditation center and a mailing list of about 500. So he was being supported in the spirit that we do here, generosity, and that was quite prevalent at that time. And this Suparaka, scholars think, was near Mumbai, somewhere near Mumbai, so down in west central India. And he is meditating, as good teachers should do. And this reflection arose in his mind. Am I one of those in the world who are arahats, who are enlightened, or who have entered the path to arahantship, to awakening? It's a pretty bold question. This guy's a teacher, he's well respected, and yet he's still questioning his practice, you know. Am I really on the right path? It's like the Buddha did, right? I mean, the Buddha studied with these basically the best teachers of his day and mastered those concentration practices, but he kept questioning, you know, has this really freed me? Am I really free? You know, I feel great when I'm in those jhana states, but when I come out of them and start going in the world, I'm not free. I'm still being tormented by greed, hatred, and delusion. So he questioned and he kept searching. Bahia is similar. So then, this part you'll have to suspend judgment a little bit. A spirit shows up, a dewata. A spirit shows up who's supposedly the reincarnation of a former blood relative. And this is interesting. Being compassionate and wishing to benefit him, he approached Bahia and said, "You, Bahia, are neither an arahant, nor have you entered the path to arahantship. You do not follow that practice whereby you could be an arahat or enter the path to arahantship."
Dear.
Yeah, oh dear. So, out of compassion and wishing to benefit him, he tells him, "You may be a great teacher and you may have all these people doing everything you say, but your practice is worthless." And not only that, but you could keep doing it for 100 years and it's not going to get you anywhere. You aren't even on the right path. And you don't even have the right practice to get you on the right path. So, imagine if someone said that to you. You know, you could get defensive. You could say, "Well, so-and-so told me this was the right path." You could ignore the person. You could say, "Oh, you're just a dream. You're a nightmare, more like it, you know." He didn't do that. He said, in the world, including the devas, So he's even open to other realms here. Who are arahats, or those who have entered the path to arahantship? So here this accomplished person is willing to just change his practice on the spot, now that he's found out that it's not working. And the answer is, there is Bahia in a far country. Remember, India wasn't all big, one big country at this time, right? It's all these little realms. There is, in a far country, a town called Savatthi. There the Lord now lives, who is the Arahat, the fully enlightened one. That Lord, Bahia, is indeed an Arahat, and he teaches Dhamma for the realization of that Arahatship. Okay. Then Bahia of the bark cloth, profoundly stirred by the words of that Devata, then and there departed from Suparaka. And it says, stopping only for one night everywhere along the way, he went to Savatthi. Some translations, you may hear this story in a different version, some translations say he went the whole way in one night. But Ireland said, well, that's not really what the Pali says, and besides, common sense tells us he wouldn't do it in one night, unless he had some kind of supernatural powers, which we don't need to believe those things here. So it was at that time they said it was 120 yojanas, with each one being equivalent to about 6 miles. So that's 720 miles. Their GPSs weren't quite as good as ours, so it's about, from what I hear, it's about 1,000 miles from Mumbai to Savatthi. That's a long walk. That's a really long walk. He set out then and there, you know. And, I mean, he has all these followers. If he stays at the coast, he has, you know, he probably had a talk to give the next night. And yet he left all that behind, right? He left his support, people that were supporting him, and just took off right there. And, you know, if they were anything like the monks today, he didn't have a lot of extra food with him. He just took off. So one assumes that he begged on the way. But eventually, he, however long 700 to 1,000 mile takes, he gets there, spending one night each time. So, you know, I really love this, profoundly stirred by the words. He set off then and there. And I think all of us, at some point in our practice careers, and maybe in our lives related to other things, have been stirred by something to move on. We've been touched by someone, a friend, being honest with us, maybe, pointing out our faults. Or we've come to a realization on our own that maybe the way we've been living our lives just isn't working quite right. And then at some point, have had the courage to try something new. I don't know that anybody here was born into this practice or born into Buddhism. So all of us at some point in our journey have been stirred profoundly by our experience and decided to do something in a different way. So I find Bahia very inspiring in that way, that he had a good thing going. I mean, he had support. He had people that believed in him. I'm sure he kept hearing from everybody what a great guy he was. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been following him. And yet, he was willing to leave all that behind and the practice that he had been doing for a long time and walk across many countries, would have been at that time, leave the coast behind and go into this Ganges plain and find this guy they were calling the Buddha, the fully enlightened one. So he shows up, and where the Lord was staying in the Jetta Wood at Anadapindika's monastery in Savatthi. And I love this image. At that time, a number of bhikkhus were walking up and down in the open air. And those of you that have been on pilgrimage have seen that in Savatthi. Practitioners walking up and down in the open air. So to feel that connection, that you don't often, I mean, sometimes you'll hear about them sitting and things like that, but it's not really often that you get this picture of the practitioners walking back and forth in the open air, just as we do here, you know. I mean, I picture on our day longs, on the Saturdays, people walking around here and out on the sidewalk and back on the lawn here. And so that image, it's just very earthy. And these early suttas don't have a lot of that formulaic repetition and all of that sort of thing. They're really down to earth and real like this. So there they are walking up and down in the open air. And Bahia approached them and said, "Where, revered sirs, is the Lord now living, the Arhat, the fully enlightened one? We wish to see that Lord who is the Arhat, the fully enlightened one. The Lord Bahia has gone for alms food among the houses." So the monastery is right next to the town, and the Buddha, apparently alone, we never hear that anybody's with him, while everybody else is practicing, has gone into town for alms food. So then Bahia hurriedly, again we get this spiritual urgency, this sambhaga that Bahia is feeling. I mean, that was it. There's no exchange. He didn't say anything. Just they say that, and he then Bahia hurriedly left the Jetta wood. Entering Savatthi, he saw the Lord walking for alms food in Savatthi. Pleasing, lovely to see, with calm senses and tranquil mind, attained to perfect poise and calm, controlled, a perfected one, watchful with restrained senses. I guess that's how he knew he was the Buddha. Hadn't seen him before, and no pictures on his Facebook page or anything. So, again, very down-to-earth descriptions. You know, we're not hearing about elongated earlobes or, you know, one finger shorter than the other or anything like that. Just very down-to-earth descriptions of someone that we might even encounter today that's accomplished in this practice. Calm senses, tranquil mind, watchful with restrained senses, you know. A good practical description of what someone might look like when they've done this practice for a while. On seeing him, he approached, fell down with his head at the Lord's feet and said, "Teach me Dhamma, Lord, teach me Dhamma, Sugata." Sugata means one who has gone to bliss. It's that same root as Sukha, you know. There's Dukkha, suffering, there's Sukha, that's happiness. So Sugata is one that's gone to bliss. "So that it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." Those of you who didn't know the formula of these suttas, you think the Buddha gave him the teaching right then? No. He has to ask again. Interesting thing about this one is he doesn't ask in the same way. Here's what he says. The Buddha tells him, "No, it's an unsuitable time, Bahia. We've entered among the houses for alms food. You get one meal a day, right?" The Buddha wants to get some food. He's been interrupted before he's been able to do that. It might be close to noon, you know. Maybe he can't guarantee that he's even going to get any food today. So the second time, Bahia says, listen to the difference. "It is difficult to know for certain, revered sir, how long the Lord will live or how long I will live. Teach me Dhamma, teach me Dhamma Sugata, so it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." So isn't that the essence of this urgency? Right? Life is short. And Bahia understands that. So now we know what was behind that urgency. He knows, he got something out of his practice, right? Wasn't maybe as worthless as it was being painted. He came to understand that life is short and we're all going to die, and, you know, get on it. I mean, let's be in a hurry. Let's go after what we need to go after. The Lord said to Bahia, "It is an unsuitable time, Bahia. We have entered the houses for alms food." So his answer stays the same. Third time, Bahia said to the Lord, "It is difficult to know for certain how long the Lord will live or how long I will live. Teach me Dhamma." So, as usual, with the three requests, the Buddha relents and he gives him this teaching. "Herein, Bahia, you should train yourself thus." I love the way these are always framed in trainings. It's not you should learn. It's not you should get to know. It's you should train. "Train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way you should train yourself, Bahia. That's it. That's all he tells him. That's the training. And then sensed, we assume, takes in, you know, feeling, smelling, and tasting. So all the six sense doors, right? He just lays them out. You have six sense doors, that's the way you contact the world. When that happens, don't add anything on. All these ruminations that you have, all of these thoughts and concepts and all that, don't add anything. Imagine if you could do that. You know? I mean, that's a profound teaching. It seems simple on the face of it. Oh yeah, when you see something, just see it. But that's a deep, deep challenge. And it's thought, Lee Brazington has uncovered some research that there's a similar teaching in the Upanishads. And the bark cloth, he's usually known as Bahia of bark cloth. And there's also a sect of followers of the Upanishads that made their clothes out of fiber, you know, like a hemp or something like that. So this is another instance of the Buddha reaching someone with words that are tailored just for them. Because the Upanishad is very, very similar to this, but I didn't bring the quote with me, but it's along the same lines about the unseen seer behind the scene. And in the hearing, there's the unseen hearer. And in the sense, there's the unsensed censor. So in the religion of that time, there was this idea that the Atman, the soul or self, was connected to a larger consciousness. And the goal of the practice was to merge with that consciousness. So what he's doing is he's taking these words and he's just shifting them a little bit. He's saying, in the seeing, just the seeing. There's no unseen seer behind that. There's no unheard hearer behind the hearing. It's in the hearing, just the hearing. He's trying to say, this body, that's all we have. There's no Atman, there's no soul, there's no oversoul. There's just this life and what we have. That's it. So he expounds on that a little bit. When Bahia, for you, in the seen is merely what is seen, in the cognized merely what is cognized, then Bahia, you will not be with that. I'm just putting quotes. I didn't think they had quotes in Pali, but... when Bahia, you are not with that, then you will not be in that. When Bahia, you are not in that, then Bahia, you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. So in my write-up of this day, I said, you know, it's one of the most clear and concise teachings. Well, that kind of pertains to the first part. The second part is not all that clear. You will not be with that. You'll not be in that. When you're not in that, you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. What do you think that means?
Speak to the lack of a sense of self at that point.
Yeah.
That you are not anywhere.
Correct. Yeah. Right. So the Atman was behind that teaching that Bahia had before, right? Mm-hmm. But this is an Atman. Anatta. This is a teaching on anatta. He's saying, no, there's no permanent continuing self. There's just the senses. Sensed experience comes in, and your job is just to see it, not to add anything to it. just to see it, just to hear, just to sense, just to cognize, without adding anything on. You know, so often what we suffer from is what we add on. You know? Whether that's something that we're hearing, whether that's something that someone's trying to tell us, whether it's something that we see. It's what we add on that causes the suffering. And he's telling him, you know, there's really, you're exactly right, there's no you to be here or there or in or out or with or without. So there's just experience. And your job is to notice that experience, to be aware. In the seeing, just the seeing. So far, so good, right? Now, through this brief Dhamma teaching, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth was immediately freed from taints without grasping. So, yeah, that other practice, probably not quite as bad as it was painted. Maybe his compassionate cousin felt like he needed to up the ante a little bit to get Bahia on the road. But obviously, his practice had, you know, gotten him pretty close to freedom. And all he needed to do was to hear this teaching, because the Buddha, the genius that he is, knew just the words that would be able to reach through to him, gave those words, and he was immediately freed from the taints without grasping. Then the Lord, having instructed Bahia with this brief instruction, went away. A little different too. You know how often when people are enlightened, they go, "Oh, I go to you, Buddha, for refuge," and I'm going to, you know, there's this formulaic thing on a lot of the sutras. You don't see that here. Just Buddha goes back. I hope he got some food. Not long after the Lord's departure, a cow with a young calf attacked Bahia of the bark cloth and killed him.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we had this urgency. He just flat out stated it in so many words. You know, Buddha, you could die, I could die, any of us could die. His urgency was based in this realization that life is short. And you know what? Life is short. Life is short. And he found that out. Now, luckily for him, he was fully enlightened before he died. Didn't get to enjoy it on this earth anyway. But he was killed. So, you know, that the story to me talks about really the beginning, the middle, and the end of practice. I mean, it talks about the beginning and the urgency, and then just constantly examining our practice and asking ourselves, is this really doing anything, you know? Am I really engaging this practice with a fresh mind? And is it taking me anywhere? And then, you know, hearing something new for the first time, I mean, he hears this simple teaching and it frees his mind. And, you know, that's really the case for any of us when we get to the level of everyday nibbana, and, you know, maybe not expecting that we'll be fully awakened and freed of all of our attachments in any moment, but this sort of freedom from hearing something new in a fresh way is available to all of us at any time. So to really take confidence in our practice and know that if we have the right attitude of mind, we keep aware in all of our activities, that there's a real possibility that we can wake up on some level every day. His persistence, you know, he goes through and he asks the question three times. And when the first question didn't work, he tries it a different way. He reminds, the Buddha probably was quite aware of the shortness of life, but he lets the Buddha know that he also is very aware of the shortness of life, both either of the Buddha or of himself. And then, you know, this awakening, we don't hear another word from him. And he's killed. And it could happen to any of us. It happened on the drive home tonight. So just bringing a depth of intention to our practice that we want to stay moving forward on the path because we don't have a lot of time. None of us do. And, you know, Mary and I were just giving a slideshow to some friends today about India and pilgrimage. And when I was there, my sister had just died. She died 9 years ago, January 19th. And so we had pictures of, I had taken her ashes with me and put them in one of those little marigold bolts they give you and put them out on the Ganges. And, you know, she was 53 when she died. So it can happen to any of us. So that realization, you know, and we don't want, we need to distinguish between that samvega, that wholesome spiritual urgency, from, you know, kind of a locked down agitation or anxiety about, you know, existential angst. I mean, we have to balance the seriousness with which we're practicing. We have to balance that with, you know, the true joy that we do find in practice when we take it seriously. It's kind of a paradox, as so many things are in this practice. When we take this practice seriously, it brings us joy. As long as we let the joy infuse our practice, then we can continue to practice seriously. So, any thoughts about the various messages of this story of Bahia? Any reflections on your own practice and how it relates to this story?
I wonder, I don't know, why we want to get rid of the me?
It's not the me we're getting rid of, it's the clinging to the me. It's the attachment to the me. So, the Buddha taught this anatta a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. This one isn't one of the more common of the six sense doors. One of the ways he taught it was as the four elements. You know, earth, fire, water, and air. Mm-hmm. You know, when you examine this body, it's not any one thing, right? It's all of these elements that have just sort of come together temporarily. The way he most commonly taught it was the five aggregates. And they're called the five aggregates of clinging. So it's physical form. It's this thing we call vedana, you know, the feeling tone of experience. Mm-hmm. It's perception. Perception being when you see something, it's that ability of the mind to just label it, categorize it and label it. So in the seeing, just the seeing, bahia. But no, perception immediately slaps a label on it. It calls it something, categorizes it, pleasant, unpleasant, I like it, I don't like it, you know, that sort of thing. So that's perception. The fourth one is sankhara, which is, it's used like 18 different ways in the sutras, that word. It means things that are put together, things that are squished together. In this context, what it means is our past experience that kind of flavors how we act in the future. So it's kind of like our mental habits, our mental, the little grooves that we've created by doing the same thing over and over again. And then the last one is consciousness, not in that sense that we used it earlier of, you know, this vast universal consciousness that we're going to merge with when we die or anything like that. Rather, it's the consciousness of these five senses. So when we see something, there's contact of the visual object with the healthy sense organ, in this case the eye, and the Buddha called it eye consciousness arises. It's just the knowing of the fact that we're seeing something. Again, in the seeing, just the seeing. And so all those are things that we experience, right? Those are all things that we experience. The problem is clinging to those as a self. So what we tend to do is that we take those five aggregates and they're just processes that are happening, but we tend to say, oh, that's me. You know, that feeling of pleasant, that's me. You know, that physical form, that's me. That ability to put a label on something, you know, my ability to, you know, see a bird and know that it's a mourning dove or a scrub jay, that's me. You know, those experiences that I've had and the resultant habits that have happened, that's me. You know, my ability to see something and know it, oh, that must be me. Who else could be knowing it? Well, that's a good question to ask once in a while. Who's aware? Who is aware? So, you're not getting rid of the me, you're getting rid of the clinging to any of those single things as me. So, you know, most of this teaching would be similar to what the Christians call process theology. You know, that we're not nouns, we're verbs. We are a process in action. We are a knowing. We are a perceiving. We are a feeling. We are a cognizing. It's happening all the time. It's flowing. It's changing. It's moving. That's what we are. But to hold on to that as something solid that's going to be around forever? Sorry. Not going to happen. And Bahia knew that. And he hit the road. So, yeah. Yes?
Valentine's Day is coming up in a few days. So, a lot of people are clinging. I just wondered how you view romance and marriage and someone you're close to in loss and grief and when you lose someone you're close to without clinging. I mean, and going through the process of the bereavement period and things like that. And how do you deal with it's okay? You know, I love you, but you're gone. It's okay. I mean, you know, we study here that things are always changing. Nothing's permanent. But when you love it full-heartedly, and then things change, how do you not get attached? How is there non-attachment in the presence of change without, you know, when you have these deep feelings of emotions from the change?
Right. Now, that's a really excellent question, and it really gets to the issue of how do we apply these teachings to a lay life out in the world. I mean, there's some things in the suttas that, quite frankly, I get kind of disturbed about, where he'll give advice, the Buddha will give advice to somebody that, oh, well, you're just sad because you're clinging to that person, that, you know, that loved one that you've left behind or whatever. And I know a lot of people have a lot of trouble with the fact that the Buddha walked away from his wife and newborn son. So it's a really challenging question, and I don't have all the answers to it. I don't think, personally, that feeling sadness for someone that's died is a sign that you have some kind of unhealthy attachment going on. I think it's just a sign that you're human. And there are stories of the Buddha, you know, grieving. When he came back to his homeland and Sariputta and Moggallana were, you know, had died, he was really upset. And he said, he told people, you know, I'm sad because they're gone. So I think that grieving, healthy grieving for one that we've lost, you're absolutely right, that's a sign that we love the person, you know. And I don't, you know, somebody might correct me, but I don't feel like that's an unhealthy attachment. I think grief, as long as we stay open to it and don't try to make it any certain way, is an absolutely appropriate response to losing someone. So it's a challenge, and you know, maybe I'm not that much of a Pali scholar to know if there are different words for attachment. Just like there are different words for desire, you know, there's tanha, which is clinging, but then or craving rather, tanha, which is craving, but then there's also chanda, which can be a healthy kind of desire. Chanda, I mean, you know, desire for awakening, like Bahia had. You know, I mean, he's told that his practice isn't working, and he wants this teacher, you know, that's 1,000 miles away, so he takes off in search of that. I don't think that's an unhealthy desire, but I'm not a Pali scholar at all, so I don't know if there are different words for attachment, but I just feel in my heart that there are healthy ways of grieving for ones that we've loved that don't mean that we're, you know, stuck and not, you know, able to move forward in our practice or our understanding of what life is all about. Yeah, thank you. It's a deep question, and I don't have all the answers.
Newbie in my practice and have a good, fairly simple understanding, but sort of springboarding off the question you asked, this idea of anatta is the way I've read different interpretations of it. First I was just confused by, like, well, how can there be a no self, and sort of the beginner's confusion around that, and then I started reading different interpretations, and this idea that at least one flavor of it is that it's like it's constant impermanence. At an organic cellular level, there's just this constant churn. There's all these processes that are in a constant state of morphing, right? And so, you know, I find it sort of grok that at a certain point, that like the whole thing is like real impermanent from top to bottom, from inside, outside. And then going back to this business of somebody dying, I experienced the death of my father before I grasped that. And in some sort of primitive, simplistic way, when he died, it knocked me ass over tea kettle. I was stunned that he died. It was shocking to me, even though, you know, I'm a rational person. Of course he's going to die, but it blew my mind. But then I got sort of acquainted with this idea of anatta, and then when my mother died, I, for whatever reason, even though I grieved her loss, there was some sense of like, well, it was never meant to go on forever. There's really nothing wrong here. This is what it is. And somehow it became okay at some level. And so the level of neurotic attachment and sort of being ass over a tea kettle that I experienced when my dad died was a very different experience with like this grasping of this anatta when my mother passed. It was like, yeah, I'm gonna miss her. She was really cool. But you know what? There's nothing wrong. This is what it is. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense? Or am
makes
I like
a lot of sense. Yeah.
Crack? I just studied this stuff on my own.
No, thank you very much. That was beautiful. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah, I don't think it's coincidental that my first day in Dennis's beginning class was exactly a year to the day after my dad died. So, you know, we get these messages.
Yeah.
And sometimes we act on them.
Well, I think the recognition of the impermanence of everything makes us appreciate the moment all the more. You know? I'm just really recognizing that this the now is what we do have.
Mm-hmm.
I know for me, it's made a difference in terms of just being really appreciative
right.
of the world and my life and the people around me and everything. So.
That's right. Yeah, and the other aspect of it, of both the impermanence and the anatta, is exactly that it helps us to appreciate the given moment, the present moment. But thank goodness. I mean, because all of us are here because of some way we wanted to change. If there was no change, if things were permanent, if our self was a locked-in victim of karma that was destined to, you know, end up somewhere no matter what our efforts are, then it would be pointless to even be here. If we weren't subject to change, you know, and I'm going to talk about trivial things like your hair turning gray, but if we weren't subject to change, if we weren't able to change, why would we even be here? You know, Bahia changed his practice and achieved some kind of freedom. All of us have come to this practice for a reason. It's because we wanted something to change, you know, and I mean, you know, some of us may have been experiencing more suffering than others, but all of us are on some kind of spiritual search because we want things to be different than they are. Nothing wrong with that. You know, there's nothing wrong with wanting the amount of carbon dioxide to go down in the atmosphere. There's nothing wrong with, you know, wanting the lives of children and grandchildren to be better than they appear like they might be. There's nothing wrong with having a spiritual practice in the hopes that we'll make some positive changes in our life. If it wasn't for impermanence and anatta, we'd be stuck with whatever we're born with, right? You know? If it wasn't for impermanence, we wouldn't even develop as human beings. But if it wasn't for that fact that this image of ourselves that we hold as being me, if that wasn't subject to change, then there wouldn't be any point in practice, really.
But one of the things that seems to me about change is what it allows in because if I remember change, then whoever I'm dealing with, whatever they did some past time or I thought they did or whatever, it allows me the possibility of seeing them differently,
mm-hmm.
just as I can see myself differently, which then allows relationships to evolve and is very freeing. And one of the things I've noticed at times is if there was somebody that I had a difficulty with in the past, maybe it was something that I did, one of the things that's the most difficult is where I've really changed, I think, and they can't see me as different than however they saw me at that time, which has made me increasingly aware of the importance of seeing change so that I don't apply that staticness
right.
to somebody else, and then the judgment that goes with the staticness and the hardening of mm-hmm. all of that.
So it opens up the possibility of forgiveness, compassion. Yeah, people that don't buy the whole metaphysical interpretation of the suttas say that the way we should read these passages, like this spirit showing up, you know, it was a blood relative of Bahia, is that it's his own, it's another aspect of his own mind speaking to him. So if you think of it in that way, it's what you're talking about. All of a sudden, you came to a new realization around this relationship. Same thing here. He's asking himself, well, am I one of those people that's on the right path? And some part of his mind is saying, nope, time to get on with it. You know. So.
When was
long as we're using grief as a then in a sense, I very much appreciated your comments about the death, but when my father died, I remember my grief, I thought to myself, I've never had such a pure emotion, a simple loss. And so maybe it's when you grieve, you just grieve, that you feel the loss, you feel the pain, but not, and it changes so that in the first 6 months it's very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch that process and just not be attached to any one phase, mm-hmm. and to not, would be odd to say not personalize it, because it's obvious it has to do with the personal relationship. But I do remember that sense of this pain being quite pure. Nothing like depression, nothing like anger. It was just simple loss.
Mm.
And maybe that's, and it changes over time. So maybe that's part of that. If you just feel it the way it is,
mm-hmm.
and not cling to that feeling, and just walk out it, change.
In the grieving, just the grieving.
And the grieving is mm-hmm. just the grieving.
Yeah. yeah.
And necessary and actually wonderful, mm-hmm. but not to. When I say personalized, I mean I guess not put a story. This is my particular grief.
Right.
No, this is grief. This is
mm-hmm. Right. Okay. I mean, that's certainly been the value of, like, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work, where she points out, well, everybody goes through these various stages of denial, bargaining, you know, anger, acceptance, and not in that order, you know, it's all mixed up and individual of how it actually gets expressed, but the fact that it's this universal human process that, you know, is, again, kind of takes the person out of it. It's just something that we all go through at some level.
Bahia was basically doing the job, but there was a piece missing.
Mm-hmm.
How can we identify that there is an extra thing that we are missing when what we're doing actually is working, but there's something else?
Yeah. Right. There's a really great article by Munindo, Ajahn Munindo, in the Buddha Dharma, the last one, where he talks about technique, meditation technique, and that only gets you so far. And then the art comes in. And it's an art. Knowing that missing piece is an art. That's where the art comes in. So you can use the technique over and over again, just like Bahia, he's using his technique, whatever it was, he was using that over and over again, and at some point, something within him said, there's something missing. And I think that's how it happens, and we talk about intuitive insight. And at some point, it will arise. That realization of what's missing will arise as a result of our observations. If we can just observe and not get tangled up in what we're observing, you know, both in seeing and hearing and also in the thoughts within our own mind and in our own emotions, if we can really just see them for what they are and stay open to that and do that with the purpose of understanding our suffering. We're not just doing it to torture ourselves. We actually want to understand our suffering, because the way that we move beyond it is to understand it. That's the first of the four noble truths, or what Stephen Batchelor calls the fourfold task. The first part of that is understanding, comprehending suffering. And we do that, if we're willing to stay there, then insight arises. Some intuitive thing, it's not linear, it's not something that we figured out. It's just something that arises in the mind and heart and informs us that's not working anymore. I need to try something different. So I don't think there's any technique that I can recommend or any length of time or any of that. It's where the technique ends and the art begins, is knowing that. Knowing what's missing, knowing whether we need a teacher, knowing who that person would be. All of those levels of practice they're intuitive and they're the art part of it, not the technique part. We need the technique. To start with, you have to have the technique. I remember, trying to meditate on my own without having any kind of basis or Buddhist teaching. And basically, I was closing my eyes and thinking. That's really all that was happening. I didn't have any technique. I didn't know why I was doing it. I just knew, I heard this meditation stuff's pretty cool. Let's try it. Useless, So we do need technique. But for the kind of fault line shifts that we're talking about here, that's going to come from intuitive insight. That's going to come from the art of the practice. Sorry, I don't have a more concrete answer for you. If there's no one else that needs to share, let's close with a kindness meditation together and a sharing of whatever good energy has arisen from our community gathering here tonight. So just acknowledging the deep challenge of being human, being real, staying open to the urgency, inherent in our limited lifespans, but at the same time open to the joy of the present moment, the joy of little letting goes, the joy of rounding a corner and getting beyond a difficulty, of repairing a relationship, savoring a life well lived even when the person is gone. Acknowledging that life has pleasant and unpleasant experiences, and if we're going to be truly free, we need to be open to both. Resolving in some minute way each day when we see something to just see it. When we hear something, just hear it. When we sense something, just sense it. And when we cognize something, just cognize. Knowing that practicing in this way will open our hearts to our own suffering and that of everyone around us, all living beings, including this living earth. Acknowledging the possibility of change. Setting an intention to practice to reduce suffering for ourselves and others. Wishing others peace, happiness, ease, the joy that comes from practicing generosity, gratitude, forgiveness, cultivating these qualities in our heart so that whatever good comes out of our practice tonight or in the future will be shared with all beings so that all beings may be free of suffering. Thank you for your practice.